very similar to World War sanctions. We all know that the resistance that paid its blood to liberate land won't stop at anything to provide for its people. True, this is diesel, but it smells of dignity and pride. It smells of the blood of martyrs that quenched the thirst of this land.
The tankers have unloaded their contents in several reservoirs in the Bacaw, where they will in turn be distributed to institutions and individuals in all Lebanese areas depending on demand. The first four Iranian fuel tankers docked in Syria's Banias port earlier this week. Lebanon has been mired since late 2019 in a deep financial crisis that has caused the Lebanese pound to lose around 90% of its value to the dollar. The U.S. has exacerbated the crisis by imposing a siege on Lebanon.
Some 65 heavily loaded fuel tankers have reached Lebanon, dispelling any doubt over Hezbollah's ability to import fuel due to U.S. sanctions. Hezbollah's initiative is seen not only as part of a long-term solution to the fuel crisis, but also as a strategic blow to any U.S. attempt to marginalize the resistance movement. Maryam Saleh, Al Ain, Al Bikar.
Is the UK turning into a totalitarian state? Well, according to former British Home Secretary David Blunkett, they are certainly heading in that direction, with the proposed police crime and sentencing courts bill, which is being debated this week. He is not alone. 600,000 Brits put their name to a petition calling for the bill to be dropped, including 700 academics. 245 organisations have also called the bill an attack on fundamental rights, along with three UN special rapporteurs and the UK's Parliamentary Joint Committee on Human Rights, who called the bill, quote, oppressive and wrong. While there are many aspects of the legislation that has worried rights groups and advocates since the bill was proposed, there is one particular aspect that has recently begun raising eyebrows.
The bill proposes to increase the sentence length for assault on emergency workers from 12 months to 2 years. On the surface, this may seem appropriate, but what some activists are concerned about is the way that this will disproportionately target people from ethnic minority backgrounds who are already significantly more likely to have force used against them than their white counterparts.
Dean alleges he was attacked by British police officers back in 2013 in the city of Manchester, but somehow found himself charged with resisting arrest.
But again, I'm 6'2", quite a big lad. Straight away, the police officer see my body as a weapon, and I got the whole, he's resisting. Next thing you know, I've got six police officers on my back, like punching me, kicking me, doing whatever. They can do things to people like me and people like you with the full knowledge that the law fully protects them. And even when, like I say, when I was basically attacked by the police, all of the officers who were there kind of corroborated the same story, which was false.
Marco, not his real name, has a similar story. He was at an anti-racist demonstration when police were seen attacking protesters, yet Marco found himself charged with assaulting emergency services. Marco asked us to distort his voice.
The police was using,
This was clear in court by the footages that the police were using disproportionate force, and there was no real reason for doing that. And they even confirmed that in their witness testimony in court. And it was incredible to see that they could just claim in court that they were just punching people in the face to stop them from going to Trafalgar Square. And this was used against me, ultimately, just because I was defending myself and those around me.
Ahmed Kabbalah, London.
Nowadays, landings of local and international flights in Kabul International Airport has turned into a familiar scene. On Wednesday, the first official flight of Iran's Mahan Airlines landed in Kabul since Taliban takeover of Afghanistan in mid-August.
Iran's Mahan Airlines flight landed in Kabul International Airport with over a dozen Iranian passengers. It would return with tens of passengers, including Afghan nationals.
Earlier, some Qatari and UN-related aircrafts had resumed their flights to and from Kabul International Airport.
There is a Qatari aircraft landing here in the Kabul International Airport. According to Taliban sources, they are struggling to attract more foreign support, especially when it comes to managing the issue of Kabul International Airport.
In the meantime, the Taliban welcomed the resumption of Iran's commercial flights to Kabul, calling on international community to add to the number of their flights, bringing humanitarian aids to Afghanistan.
We welcome the resumption of the international flights, but the fact is our countrymen need urgent humanitarian aid. So I think the resumption of such flights paves the way for the regional countries and international bodies to send more humanitarian aid to Afghanistan.
Tehran was one of the largest donors at the 2002 Tokyo conference, pledging more than India, Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, Turkey, Norway, Switzerland, Australia, and Pakistan combined. Iran is also hosting around 3 million Afghans, including around 1 million refugees and 2 million undocumented migrants, according to the United Nations. Many of them have been residing for more than four decades. Kabul International Airport resumes its commercial international flights, while Qatar and Taliban are jointly managing all security and technical issues of the airport. However, Taliban officials here say they are working to make Kabul International Airport fully operational. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
EU Foreign Policy Chief Joseph Borrell has posed a series of questions to EU legislators in the light of the Afghanistan catastrophe. He asked, what does it mean for our relations with the US? And then he went on.
What does it mean for the development of European strategic autonomy, for our security, and for our defense policy?
During the two-hour European Parliament debate, at least a dozen lawmakers told Borrell the last thing the EU needs is more military spending.
The lessons to be learned. We have to end universal interventionism that has only led to disasters in Syria, Iraq, and Afghanistan.
Apparently, the West demonstrated enormous arrogance in Afghanistan.
In overshooting self-confidence, instead of helping nation-building, we try to impose nation-building.
The US-led invasion of Afghanistan resulted in a countless number of civilian deaths and also life-changing injuries. We have visited a center for asylum seekers in Brussels. As they wait for help, people here feel let down by EU and Belgian authorities.
They don't care about women, they don't care about children. Why they do like this? What's the difference between Afghanistan and Belgium?
The plight of Afghan refugees was also talked about at length during the European Parliament debate.
The selfishness of many European authorities and political parties that showed no solidarity towards those refugees that left the country.
The reason given for going into the country to defeat terrorism was rubbished.
You were killing innocent people, women and children. You were creating terrorists, fighting migration. You were destroying the place. You were creating migrants.
The European Economic and Social Committee has published a statement pleading with EU leaders to cooperate in a meaningful way with key countries surrounding Afghanistan, including Iran, Pakistan, China, India and Russia, in order to achieve the stabilisation of Central Asia. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
The Turkish foreign minister said that Turkey is working with the United Nations to resettle Syrian refugees in Syria. Mevlut Cavusoglu added that the international community has started to understand the gravity of the situation. Cavusoglu's comments came days after a visit by UNHCR chief Filippo Grandi, who met both the foreign minister and the Turkish president. Cavusoglu underlined the importance not to force the refugees to return, but encourage them through providing them housing, education, health and employment resources.
We are now receiving better support from the international community for the safe return and repatriation of refugees. We are working to repatriate refugees, especially in Syria, especially with the UN High Commissioner for Refugees.
The AK ruling party is facing criticism from the people and opposition parties for the way it is handling the refugee crisis. Many are blaming the presence of the refugees for the rise in prices and bad economic situation. Turkish people have become very sensitive towards this issue, with some even refusing to deal with foreigners. House owners are now refusing to rent their houses to foreigners, which has created a state of racism in the country that many are calling on the government to find a solution to.
This topic particularly is considered very sensitive to Turkey, and it also concerns other countries in the region that are also hosting refugees, such as Jordan, Lebanon, and Iraq. Turkey is pushing towards this solution due to several reasons. The main one is the upcoming election and the opposition using the refugee card against the ruling party. Another reason is the people's pressure, who are blaming the presence of Syrian refugees for the deteriorating economic situation in the country. Therefore, the current Turkish government is trying to fix this issue before 2023 elections.
UNHCR says Syria is still considered too dangerous to send refugees back. UNHCR spokesperson says that only a political solution would allow people to return, assuring that refugees should have the right to voluntarily return in safe and dignified conditions. However, several countries, including Turkey, are pressuring the Syrian refugees to return to their home country, claiming it is safe now for their return. Turkey has long been hosting migrants and refugees from different countries in the region. However, with the deteriorating economic situation in the country, people are now calling on their government to stop receiving more refugees and send the already existing ones home. Rahşan Saglam, Istanbul.
It was supposed to be seamless trading post-Brexit, but it doesn't seem to be working, and the developments of the past few days are a testament. The Northern Ireland Protocol, agreed upon by the UK and EU to avoid trade problems, has become a problem itself. Now the UK is threatening to unilaterally suspend it.
Article 16 says that this article can be triggered unilaterally by either side if there's some aspect of the treaty which is causing unforeseen social, economic or environmental problems. But there's nothing about the way that the Northern Ireland Protocol is operating now which is unforeseen. It has led de facto to a border between the six counties of the north of Ireland and Britain.
The warning came from Brexit Minister Lord Frost, only days after the leader of Northern Ireland's pro-UK ruling party warned of a new era of violence and instability if the protocol collapsed.
That our political institutions will not survive a failure.
The UK has been pushing for a renegotiation of the protocol, despite Prime Minister Boris Johnson promising during Brexit negotiations that it wouldn't impact the flow of goods to and from Northern Ireland.
There will not be checks on goods going from Northern Ireland to Great Britain, because we're the government of the United Kingdom and we will not institute.
A promise Boris Johnson hasn't been able to keep. Instead, he's announced grace periods since January last year to delay the agreement's full implementation. Meanwhile, the European Union, who threatened legal action but are yet to take it, say the UK made its bed and has to lie in it.
They want to have their cake and eat it. They want both to be able to satisfy their own workers at home and have a smash the red wall, claim to be in favour of Brexit, claim to be in favour of British workers, and at the same time be inside the European club.
The agreement was forged to prevent a hard border between Northern Ireland and EU member Republic of Ireland, and to protect the 1998 Good Friday Agreement. The two sides agreed that goods entering Northern Ireland from the rest of the UK had to be checked according to EU rules. That didn't sit well with the pro-UK unionists.
The Northern Ireland Protocol is underpinned by international law. Any violation of it will dent international trust in the government here. And the whole escalating row over the protocol is yet another episode in the ongoing Brexit saga, rekindling questions about whether or not the UK's divorce from the single market was a good idea after all. Saeed Furza, London.
Follow us on social media
to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/parstodayen. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/parstodayenglish.
In the limelight.
Global investment demand for gold has increased at an average of 18% each year since 2000, and a World Gold Council study found that 61% of respondents trust gold more than fiat currencies. Stay with us for an article written by Sylvia Carrasco. The piece is titled, Next Generation of Super Apps to Focus on Gold Trading. The article has been taken from the website of the Asia Times. Dominance of the super app is already unfolding in Asia, which is leading the way for the rest of the world. These super apps represent the next frontier in consumer technology, becoming so deeply integrated into the consumer's life that they become indispensable operating systems. It is clear that their success primarily originates from a native mobile payment system. Fintech integration has been a core accelerating factor. And for the next generation of super apps, offering gold trading matters more than ever. Super apps need no introduction in Asia. WeChat hosts more than a billion users, and there have been multiple super apps established throughout emerging markets, including Grab, Gojek, Kakao, and Alipay. Users can talk with friends, order food, or book a flight, all within one app, and without having to switch to any others. The app becomes a multifaceted marketplace rather than a single service offering. A native mobile payment system has been a crucial ingredient to rapid scalability, allowing one single-purpose application to partner with various businesses and offer hundreds of products and services within a single app. By comparison, financial technology is a late-blooming industry. App-based finance was a relative latecomer to digitization, with a significant level of mistrust for digital banking and an ingrained loyalty to long-established traditional banks, with face-to-face appointments preferred. However, there were signs that the COVID-19 pandemic has accelerated the shift towards digitization. A report by Baker and McKenzie showed that within the Asia-Pacific region, the pace of digital transformation has been increasing because of the impact of COVID-19, with 92% of business leaders re-evaluating their digital strategies and optimizing digital infrastructure to remain competitive in response to the pandemic. This recent shift has primed the fintech landscape to offer an expansion of their services, and startups are now competing to build out their product suites to meet increasing demand. The new generation of app users want everything ideally in one place, with minimal friction, and at the same time are more focused on their personal finance than ever before. The behavior and habits of Asia-Pacific finance consumers are rapidly evolving, with the new generation wanting to use a new suite of digital banking options, including challenger banks and fintech firms that are willing to meet their banking needs. McKinsey, the trusted advisor and counselor to many of the world's most influential businesses and institutions, reports that digital natives, those born between 1980 and 2012, including Generation Z and Millennials, are likely to drive Asia's consumption over the coming decade, as they make up more than one-third of Asia's consumer population. A recent report found that 20 to 30% of this generation spends more than 6 hours a day on their mobile phones, and more than 70% of them are very confident of meeting their financial goals. This is where the developers of the next generation of super apps need to think about the financial products that they are offering. As fintechs look to expand their global reach and product depth, sooner or later they will need to offer alternative wealth and investment products, so it's only a matter of time until they look to allocated gold. Global investment demand for gold has increased at an average of 18% each year since 2000, and a World Gold Council study found that 61% of respondents trust gold more than fiat currencies. Investors are more tuned in than ever before to innovative ways of managing their portfolios through turbulence. The recent implementation of Basel III Accord pushes the industry towards physical gold over paper, and demand for the precious metal increased by 40% from 2019 to 2020. Business-to-consumer fintechs are racing to build their product suites. It's a game of survival of the fittest. Companies are looking for geographical domination and expansion of their product offering. Lose the game, and their users will flip over to the next platform. B2B or business-to-business integrations enable super app providers to capitalize on the huge demand for allocated gold from fintech and operators of embedded finance. The firm I represent, Goldex, is already directly working with 20 fintech companies to provide a convenient option for allocated gold, creating a product that so far has no direct competition. Apps can offer their users allocated gold within 6 weeks. As the world increasingly moves towards the super app model, more companies will likely consider how they can integrate several services rather than focusing on the specialization of just one product. To tap into the full potential of global growth, services that offer business-to-business integration products that can deliver investment options like gold could shape the future of the fintech industry and the next generation of super apps.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
Algeria recently cut off diplomatic relations with neighboring Morocco over what it called successive aggressive steps by the kingdom. Now, the move came days after the Algerian High Council for Security decided to review its diplomatic relations with its neighbor. Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a warm welcome to another edition of Africa Today, a program which gives you an incisive analysis on news and events from across Africa. Now, this week, we are heading to the Maghreb region, where Algeria has decided to cut off diplomatic ties with Morocco. We are asking, what are the reasons behind the crisis between these two North African neighbors? In the second part of our program, we shall focus on how uranium mining in Niger by France continues to impact negatively on the health and environment of the dispossessed people of this country. Stay with us till the end of the show and send us your comments.
Algeria cuts ties with hostile Morocco. On the 24th of August, Algeria announced it was breaking diplomatic ties with Morocco over a number of reasons. Algerian Foreign Minister Ramtane Lamamra called a press conference in Algiers to announce the drastic decision and that his country was cutting off ties with neighboring Morocco. He criticized Rabat for never having ceased to carry out hostile, unfriendly, and malicious actions against Algeria since its independence. He also described how the Moroccan security services are waging a vile war against Algeria, its people, and its leaders. This decision came as no surprise to observers who have been closely following the deepening rift since late last year, which has escalated since July 2021 over a number of significant developments.
Now, people in Morocco's capital, Rabat, have expressed disappointment over the current diplomatic crisis between the two neighboring countries.
Alors les relations diplomatiques coupées ou la rompues avec l'Algérie, c'est vraiment un très très dommage.
Now, for more on the crisis in Algeria-Morocco ties, we have contacted Elijah Magnia, a journalist and political analyst. Thanks a lot for your time, Sam. Now, can you first tell us what, in your opinion, is the source of the hostility and tensions between Morocco and Algeria?
I think the situation between Algeria and Morocco has been hectic since a very long time. We're talking about 1976. Over the Polisario independent movement in Morocco and the Western Sahara, and also the accusation of Algeria for Morocco supporting the self-determination of Kabylie in Algeria. So there are mutual accusations between both countries, and that is really preventing these countries to develop and increase the trade and the relationship, but it's not very much affecting the population at that level.
The North African rivals have had strained relations for decades over the flashpoint disputed region of Western Sahara. They continue to accuse one another of backing opposition movements as proxies. Morocco's normalization of its relations with the Israeli regime in December last year triggered fresh tensions between Rabat and Algiers.
Now, as you mentioned earlier, the two North African states have had frosty ties for decades. So what was the main trigger that made Algeria say enough is enough and decided to cut ties with Morocco?
Recently, what happened is the Moroccan delegation to the United Nations really emphasized on the Morocco support of the self-determination of Kabylie, the MAK, that are spread along the Mediterranean coast of the capital, Algeria. So Algeria considered this group as a terrorist organization. And this call by the Moroccan diplomats created really fury in Algeria that accused Morocco of even supporting the forest fire that took on in August the 9th and killed around 90 people and destroyed tens of thousands of hectares in the country. And I think it's the old and ancient bitterness between the two countries that is triggering this animosity and is allowing it to flare from now and then. And now, for the second time, there is a cut of relationship between the two countries.
Now, Algeria has emerged as a leading African and Arab voice in supporting the aspirations of an independent Palestine. The people of Algeria are fiercely pro-Palestinian, and most people oppose the normalization of ties with the Israeli regime. President Abdelmadjid Tebboune has also categorically rejected the normalization of ties with the Israeli regime. Now, do you think the Israeli regime has a role in inciting Morocco's hostility towards Algeria, and what does the regime stand to gain?
Well, this is a good question, because when President Trump accepted to recognize the Morocco's sovereignty over the Western Sahara in exchange of resuming ties or normalization, the normalization with Israel, that triggered something in that part of the world, because it means that Morocco is seeking this recognition and is supporting Israel, while Israel is accusing Algeria of being close to Iran. And we saw recently the visit of the Israeli Foreign Minister Yair Lapid, who also accused Algeria of having a relationship with Iran, and is supporting Morocco against Algeria. And I think the Israelis, wherever there is a possibility to put oil on fire, they really don't pull back. On the contrary, they move forward because they want other African countries to follow suit the decision of the King Mohammed of Morocco in relation to Israel, of course.
South Africa, considered one of the most powerful countries in the continent, has been at the forefront advocating for the end of Morocco's rule over the Western Sahara region. Speaking when he hosted Sahrawi leader Brahim Ghali, South African President Cyril Ramaphosa said he is certain that the people of Western Sahara will eventually get self-determination and be free.
The suffering that the people of Sahrawi are going through now in refugee camps will be sufficient evidence that indeed this colonization should come to an end, because it is an affront to us as the people of Africa that we should in this day and age still have one country within the African continent that does not have self-determination, that is not independent.
Algeria, just like many African countries, backs the independence of the Western Sahara region currently occupied by Morocco. How will this issue affect Morocco's ties with other African countries, especially after the US recognized Rabat's claim over the region?
It will affect it because the Algerian stand is with the Palestinian movement, with the Palestinian cause, with Gaza, and with the Palestinian state. And by the recognition of Morocco over the Western Sahara and the acknowledgement of Morocco to normalize with Israel, that deeply affects the position in favor of the Palestinian right of return, right of state, and the Palestinian cause, and recognize what Israel is doing to the Palestinian, and that seriously affect the position, particularly when these countries are in harmony with Lebanon, Syria, Gaza, and other countries that support the Palestinian cause.
Algerian Foreign Minister has warned that insistence on granting Israeli regime observer status at the African Union could lead to the disintegration of this continental body. Algiers is leading a group of powerful African countries opposing Israel's observer status in this pan-African body.
Now, last question to you. What are some of the regional implications for Algeria's decision to cut ties with Morocco, especially considering the fact that Algiers is leading a campaign to reject Israeli regime's observer status at the African Union?
Well, the consequences will be on Morocco economic situation, because apart from the borders between Algeria and Morocco are closed since 1994, however, there is a gas line, there's a Morocco-Europe pipeline that goes from Algeria to Morocco, to Spain, And that was supposed to start in October 2021, and Algeria is going to bypass it and use the Medgaz without going through Morocco. And that will affect the Moroccan economy because of the unilateral decision of Morocco to normalize with Israel. And also it will affect the trade between Libya, Tunisia, Algeria, Mauritania, Morocco, because the level of trade today is around the 2.8%, and it was due to raise until 6 to 10%. Therefore, all this, because of Morocco's decision to normalize with Israel, the Algerian reaction will give a second example what can happen to other African countries if they resume normalization with Israel. And there are going to be counter-reaction from those who don't want to normalize with Israel and believe in the rightness of the Palestinian cause.
While it's quite evident that the Israeli regime is pursuing a devious plan of sowing the seeds of discord in Africa, and this can only be to the detriment of African countries and the Palestinian cause. Thanks a lot for your incisive analysis. We shall now take a short break, and when we come back, we are going to talk about France's dirty secrets in Niger. Stay with us.
Radioactive legacy in Niger.
You're listening to Africa Today. Africa Today is an analytical weekly review of political, economic, and social events in Africa, the world's second largest continent. The series is broadcast every week on Saturdays and Sundays by IRIB English Radio.
Niger, a landlocked nation in West Africa, has some of the world's largest uranium reserves, around 7% of the global total. The uranium is used to fuel nuclear power plants, which are mostly located in European, North American, and some Asian countries.
Production of uranium at the Cominak mine in Niger's Agadez region came to an end in March this year after over 40 years of operations. During the four decades, the mining operations by this French company produced more than 75,000 tons of elemental uranium. However, the company's plan for dismantling the mine site has been termed as unsatisfactory by the local population and environmentalists. The main disagreement is the management of massive radioactive waste stored in the open air. Uranium mining operations in Niger have left behind a trail of poverty and environmental destruction.
Now, to discuss more on French-owned uranium mines in Niger and the pain and suffering they have brought for the people of this impoverished country, we have contacted Eric Wahlberg, a journalist and political analyst. Thanks a lot for your time, sir. Now, first, how is the radioactive waste from the abandoned mines affecting the people of this part of Niger?
You look at the way it's mined, and it's devastating. It's the open pit mines ruin the environment, great amounts of radioactive dust are constantly swirling around in the desert climate, like Niger, where there's wind sweeping. It's constantly in people's lungs. The rate of cancer is very alarmingly high, and especially lung cancer. And it's not only the use of these radioactive materials, which can be up to 500 times the safe level. But it's also the use of the groundwater. Millions of liters of groundwater. This is in a desert, and all the water is being used to create uranium. So really, the waste effects are ongoing now.
Thanks a lot, Mr. Wahlberg, for your insight.
Though Niger got its independence in the 1960s, France still plays an influential role in the country, thereby playing a monopoly game to tap its natural resources. Since the discovery of uranium in Niger, a major chunk of this mineral has been exclusively exported to France by Areva, the state-owned nuclear power company of France. Locals who worked in the mines are suffering from unknown diseases and say that they are treated like animals by French companies running the uranium mines. French companies own most of the uranium mines in Niger, including the abandoned Comanac mine. Are these companies carrying out their responsibility to clean up their mess?
People live in terror of, they're afraid to speak out. The journalists wanted to come and interview people, and they said, don't say you're talking about uranium. You want to say you're talking about migrant laborers leaving Arlit to go to Algeria because they've gotten the work. You can talk about that, but don't. So it's very much in the old vision of how, especially in the United States, where reporters would try and investigate and they would be killed. Or you could say, you know, it's going on everywhere in the world. That reporters really are intimidated into not reporting the news. So the French is not, the company is not responsible, and so it tries to hide that fact. So, this company, the original contract was made in 1968, and when finally, through Freedom of Information or through Doctors Without Borders, they were able to get evidence of what the actual contract was. It was all secret. And it turns out there were no taxes being paid, no excise taxes, no use of local resources. Basically, it was a free ride for this powerful company, which is one of the richest in the world. So it's siphoning all the wealth to its own, to France and to its shareholders and whatever, and leaving the people, as I said, Niger is the 187th out of 188. It's right at the bottom of the UN Human Development Index. So it's a terrible, terrible situation.
Niger, with a population of more than 23 million, remains one of the poorest countries on the planet as per the Development Index of the United Nations. More than 43% of its population is living below $1.25 per day. French companies mining uranium in Niger are not only looting the country's wealth, but they have destroyed the environment.
Now, uranium in Niger was supposed to be a blessing for the people, but apparently this wealth is now a curse, as masses languish in poverty while foreign countries, especially France, make massive profits from this natural resource. What went wrong?
Well, it's the it used to be called, or it still is called, the oil curse. And originally that was a name that was given to the Dutch, who had some oil in Holland, and they started, after World War II, started to mine it, but it turned out that it created horrible pollution, and the profits just went to the all the benefit went to the so-called shareholders, to the owners of the company, and all it left behind was sickness. Oil is horrible. It's right up there with uranium. It's a poison, a toxin, and so it leaves the people sick. And it leaves the money in the mother country, in this case, in the case of Niger, France.
Well, French companies have exported billions of dollars worth of uranium from Niger over the years. In 2010, Greenpeace conducted an analysis in Niger and found that the uranium contamination in 4 out of 5 water samples exceeded World Health Organization safety limits. Now, is there hope that French mining companies will stop the pillage and destruction of Niger, and the people will eventually benefit from their country's uranium?
It's really hard to fight a big company. And what we really need is to, as part of this environmental movement now, we have to really, as this documentary is doing, is focus on these horrible violations of humanity that are done in the name of clean energy. There's nothing clean about what's going on in winter. And the hope is only through continual struggle and continual attempts to deal with these problems on a world scale. We must go back to the UN. All of these issues are really best met through a neutral international organization.
Well, there you have it. Mr. Oldberg says neutral international organizations need to intervene and stop the plundering of countries like Niger, which are rich in natural resources but suffer exploitation by Western multinationals. And on that note, we come to the end of this week's edition of Africa Today. Let us know what you think by dropping us a line through our social media handle. Until our next episode, it's goodbye for now.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
The limelight.
The mainstream media's focus on Israeli regime's Pegasus spyware and the threats it poses means that other companies like Toka go uninvestigated, even when their products present an even greater potential for abuse and illegal surveillance, says Whitney Webb, journalist, in an article titled Toka, Most Dangerous Israeli Regime Spyware Firm. Stay tuned, please, for the details of this article. recently an investigation into the global abuse of spyware developed by veterans of Israeli regime spying unit 8200 gained widespread attention as it was revealed that the software sold to democratic and authoritarian regimes alike had been used to illegally spy on an estimated 50,000 individuals. Among those who had their communications and devices spied on by the software, known as Pegasus, were journalists, human rights activists, business executives, academics, and prominent political leaders. Among those targeted political leaders, per reports, were the current leaders of France, Pakistan, South Africa, Egypt, Morocco, and Iraq. The abuse of Pegasus software in this very way has been known for several years, though these latest revelations appear to have gained such traction in the mainstream owing to the high number of civilians who have reportedly been surveilled through its use. The continuation of the now years-long scandal surrounding the abuse of Pegasus has also brought considerable controversy and notoriety to Israeli regime company that developed it, the NSO Group. While the NSO Group has become infamous, other Israeli companies with even deeper ties to the regime's intelligence apparatus have been selling software that not only provides the exact same services to regimes and intelligence agencies, but purports to go even further. Originally founded by former Israeli regime Prime Minister and Jeffrey Epstein associate Ehud Barak, one of these companies' wares are being used by regimes around the world, including in developing countries with the direct facilitation of global financial institutions like the Inter-American Development Bank, IDB, and the World Bank. In addition, this software is only made available to governments that are trusted by the Israeli regime, which works closely with the company. Toka was launched in 2018 with the explicit purpose of selling a tailored ecosystem of cyber capabilities and software products for governmental law enforcement and security agencies. According to a profile of the company published in Forbes shortly after it launched, Toka advertised itself as a one-stop hacking shop for governments that require extra capability to fight terrorists and other threats to national security in the digital domain. Toka launched with plans to provide spy tools for whatever device its clients require, including not only smartphones, but a special focus on the so-called Internet of Things. Per the company, this includes devices like Amazon Echo, Google Nest, connected home products, as well as connected fridges, thermostats, and alarms. Exploiting these products, discovered by Toka, the company said at the time, would be disclosed to vendors, meaning those flaws would continue to remain vulnerable to any hacker, whether a client of Toka or not. Today, Toka's software suite claims to offer its customers in law enforcement, government, and intelligence the ability to obtain targeted intelligence and to conduct forensic investigations as well as covert operations. In addition, Toka offers governments its cyber designer service, which provides agencies with the full spectrum strategies, customized projections, and technologies needed to keep critical infrastructure, the digital landscape, and government institutions secure and durable, unquote. Given that NSO's Pegasus targets only smartphones, Toka's hacking suit, which, like Pegasus, is also classified as a lawful intercept product, is capable of targeting any device connected to the Internet. including but not limited to smartphones. In addition, its target clientele are the same as those of Pegasus, providing an easy opportunity for governments to gain access to even more surveillance capabilities than Pegasus offers, but without risking notoriety in the media, since Toka has long avoided the limelight. Why Toka professes that its products are only used by trusted governments and agencies to combat terrorism and maintain order and public safety, the sales pitch for the NSO Group's Pegasus is remarkably similar, and that sales pitch has not stopped its software from being used to target dissidents, politicians, and journalists. It also allows many of the same groups who are Toka clients, like intelligence agencies, to use these tools for the purpose of obtaining blackmail. The use of blackmail by Israeli regime agencies against civilian Palestinians to attempt to weaken Palestinian society and for political persecution is well documented. Toka has been described by market analysts as an offensive security company, though the company's leadership rejects this characterization. Company co-founder and current CEO Yaron Rosen asserted that as opposed to purely offensive, the company's operations are something in the middle, which he classifies as bridging cyber defense and offensive cyber activities, that is, hacking. The company's activities are concerning in light of the fact that Toka has been directly partnered with the Israeli regime's Ministry of War and other Israeli regime intelligence and security agencies since its founding. The company works closely with these regime agencies, according to an Israeli Ministry of War website. This collaboration per Toka is meant to enhance their products. Toka's direct IDF links are in contrast to the NSO Group, a company that does not maintain overt ties to the Israeli regime security state. Further evidence that Toka is part of this Israeli regime effort to seed foreign governments and regimes with technology products deeply tied to the Israeli regime's military and intelligence services is the fact that one of the main investors in Toka is Dell Technologies Capital, which is an extension of the well-known tech company Dell. The NSO Group and its Pegasus software is clearly a major scandal that deserves scrutiny. However, the treatment of the incident by the media has largely absolved the Israeli regime of any role in that affair, despite the fact that the NSO Group's sales of Pegasus to foreign regimes has been approved and defended by the Zionist regime. This, of course, means that the Israeli regime has obvious responsibility in the whole scandal as well. In addition, the myopic focus on the NSO Group when it comes to mainstream media reporting on Israeli regime private spyware and the threats it poses means that other companies like Toka go uninvestigated, even if their products present an even greater potential for abuse and illegal surveillance than those currently marketed and sold by the NSO Group. Given the long-standing history of the Israeli regime's intelligence use of technology firms for international surveillance and espionage, as well as its admitted policy of using tech companies as fronts to combat BDS and ensure the Zionist regime's cyber dominance, the investigation into Israeli regime spyware cannot stop just with NSO Group. However, not stopping there is directly challenging the Israeli regime, particularly in Toka's case, and this is something that mainstream media outlets tend to avoid.